welcome back to another episode of A Life Less Ordinary with me, Sophie Elwes, the podcast where I get to interview amazing people who've overcome huge challenges in their lives, and I find out what tips and tricks they can share for other people who might be facing challenges of their own. Karen Duck is a great example of how training your brain and reframing those negative thoughts really can work. It's helped her not only rise right to the top and win gold at a Paralympic Games, but also to completely embrace challenge in some really extreme situations. Unfortunately, the quality of the recording isn't great in some places, but a lot of what Karen says is of really good value, so I hope that you can look past it. Let me know what your thoughts are, and I hope you enjoy. Karen, great to see you. How is it going?
Yeah, good. I'm pretty chilled with the current kind of restrictions. Intrigued and curious to see where it takes us all. In terms of like the collective us all, humanity, if we change things or what will happen. But yeah, all is good personally, so I'm lucky. Clearly work's different, life's different, income's down, but probably everyone's the same. But I feel lucky to have a roof over my head and enough for food, and yeah, you know, lots of people in more challenging positions. So
yeah, absolutely. So I'm so pleased to be talking to you today. I've been reading one of your books at the moment, which is Quest 79, which I am loving. Oh my goodness.
Oh, like, good. I always say it's a good toilet book. You can just like pick it up in a toilet and have like a 2-minute read and hopefully change your perspective in a few minutes.
100%. Like, I actually, we'll talk about this in a little while, but I wish I'd read it a few years ago when I was kind of competing, because there is so much in it that is just, you know, kind of nuggets of wisdom, but really, really great advice.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you think so. My kind of bigger aim was that it wasn't really for people competing, but just for life generally. But clearly the stories all come from sport and adventure, so it's easy to relate them to those scenarios. But I think this, hopefully most of the stories are stuff that's true for anyone that's navigating life, really.
Mm. And a lot of the things I think are definitely transferable. You know, we'll talk about that more kind of later on. But yeah, there's some really kind of relatable things in there for sure.
Well, thank you to you for your article on making podcasts, because you've inspired me that I should make a podcast series based on that book. So I just need to get on and do it now.
Definitely. Well, you've got a fan in me for sure. Yeah, podcasting is the way. Definitely. So I think it would be sensible to kind of start from the beginning of this kind of part of your life. I know I'm reticent to ask you about your injury. I know for me, like, I feel kind of that it's quite tiresome when people sort of say, well, what happened to you? Or, you know, how did you break your back or whatever? But I think, you know, in this context, I think it's kind of important to ask. So if you don't mind telling us a bit about kind of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny for you to say this part of your life, because it's been such the bigger part of my life now that it feels like such a long time ago that I could walk. So yeah, I fell off a cliff rock climbing in Scotland like a really long time ago now, I think about 28 years ago. So been in a wheelchair much longer than I wasn't, paralyzed from the chest down. I don't know, it was dramatic at the time, obviously. You kind of think this is the worst thing ever, and clearly none of us would choose to be paralyzed, but I think most of us that have been paralyzed for a while would agree that it does bring you certain perspectives and insights and ways of seeing and being in the world, which, you know, maybe we just have to be positive, but we wouldn't have had them otherwise. So although I would never wish for anyone to have an accident or become paralyzed anyway, nor myself, I think, you know, there's really amazing things to be experienced, and I'm really grateful for the things that it's shown me and given me. But it is a long time ago now, and clearly, yeah, there's a big drama at the time. But
yeah. And how old were you at the time?
I was 21, very active, a mountaineer, loved climbing big mountains like Alpine mountains, but Scottish mountains, just basically being in the wilderness. I wasn't, I don't know how I ended up in Paralympic sport, because I'm competitive with myself, but I really have never really been competitive with anyone else. I just like to be outside in nature and keeping healthy and fit. So, yeah, that was my life then. I used to run a lot and ride a mountain bike and climb, but that was like before mountain bikes even had suspension and things. So it's like, seems like a really long time ago now. They
I
were like
bet.
dinosaur bikes.
Yeah, no suspension. That's got to be like uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So kind of, go taking yourself back, what was that like kind of in the time after, obviously, in hospital, and for a lot of people, and people listening now, that period of time when you leave hospital is often the hardest. At the moment with COVID, I speak to a lot of people in my work who have come out of hospital and they're not given the same sort of opportunities as certainly I was, and a lot of people usually are, like backup courses or Access Adventures courses and things like that. And they struggle because they're not able to kind of experience those new things. What was
Yeah.
that? Yeah, what was that like for you in the early stages?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I was really lucky that I had a lot of friends who were my friends who were kind of into outdoor stuff. So a large majority of them are kind of used to challenges and like challenges. So they came to me, and my very first trip out of hospital was actually, I think I was still in hospital, was skiing with backup. No, I wasn't still in hospital, but it wasn't long after. It was less than a year after my injury that I went away on a ski trip with backup. And yeah, it was life-changing. So those kinds of opportunities really do help you get the perspectives and open up the horizons about what you can do and to stay positive and see possibilities. So my heart really goes out right now to people, even have their loved ones visit. And I'm in common at the moment with a few people who have had recent spinal cord injuries this summer, and their partners are visiting the hospital, but they just have to like wave through the window and things. It's just horrendous because I know how much that social support makes a big difference. So if anyone is listening to this in that scenario, then just hang on in there because it does and will get just way better again once we can get out and about and do things and have those opportunities again. But I think when you find yourself with a new spinal cord injury, you don't have those perspectives. So at the moment, maybe the best people can do is to read about it and just like troll the internet and read books and just fill your mind with the possibility that there is possibility because there really is. And yeah, I think that's the best we can do for now.
Definitely, definitely. So I'm interested, obviously, in your kind of hand cycling journey, from reading your book and hearing you talk about Project Olympic. Is that what you called it?
I think
And
I called
how
it my
that,
Olympic experiment. Yeah,
there you
Olympic
go, that's
experiment.
the one. Tell me, like, how you started off hand cycling and what that was like.
So my very first hand cycle was a tandem, and it was kind of before hand cycling was really a thing. When I was injured, it was still kind of everyone just did athletics or wheelchair racing. And I did do that, but I never really enjoyed it, if I'm honest. You're just kind of looking at the ground and not being able to look up at where you're going. And it's actually interesting. So I'm trained in a technique called brain spotting, just a new thing for me this year, which is about kind of releasing trauma and helping find new perspectives. But it's all about how where you look affects how you feel. And I really think that when you look down, it doesn't help you feel as good. So when I discovered hand cycling and you're like looking up at the sky, I call it like a mobile sunbed on wheels, it just makes you feel better. Like your chest is open, you see the horizon. And so my first hand bike was a tandem that I had made in Australia. And the idea was that we would cycle it across the Himalayas. And it was like this crazy, it seemed like a crazy thing just to come out of hospital and be going, right, we're going to go and hand cycle across the Himalayas. And everyone I spoke to was just telling me, you're nuts, you're crazy, it's so dangerous, what will you do? And the plan was to do it completely unsupported. So just to go with a few friends, just like I used to, carry our kit, tow the wheelchair and see what happened. So that's why I got the tandem. I thought, well, if I get a tandem, people can't ride away from me. Like I'll be stuck with one friend at least, and at least we'll go at the same speed. So I pedaled it with my arms on the front, and someone on the back pedals it with their legs. And it's like a double recumbent. So it's just this crazy machine. I've still got it. I went out on it this summer, actually, and it was just so cool. It's so long since I've been out on it, but it has been in a museum in Glasgow for about 4 years, the European Transport Museum. But that was my first bike, and that changed my life, especially to go and find myself cycling across the Himalayas from we started in Kazakhstan to Kyrgyzstan and then across into Western China and then across the western end of the Karakoram and Himalaya Mountains down to Pakistan. And it was all dirt roads, like impassable, only just open borders. It was really difficult to arrange everything. Just a massive adventure and amazing. And I think, I think when you have a spinal cord injury or your circumstances change in life, you just need that first experience that gives you that extra bit of belief that, you can still do interesting, exciting things. So anyone out there listening who's fairly newly injured, I just encourage you to, I call it having a wouldn't it be amazing? Something that you really kind of feels like a bit scary, something that's a bit of a stretch, but you're kind of really up for it because it kind of excites you, even if it scares you, just to find that and go
Absolutely.
for
It sounds like
it.
an incredible trip. Like, how long injured were you when you did that?
So I think that was, oh, now you're asking. I think it was 2 or 3, 3. No, it was 3 years after injury because I was doing a postgrad in geology. So I was injured basically just after I'd started that, and then it took me 3 years. So I went on the ride at the end of that. So yeah, 3 years in.
That's pretty good going.
There were a few little training trips. I don't know why we thought the Outer Hebrides with Scotland was the perfect place to train for the Himalayas, but that's where our training trips were to.
Amazing. And so how where did the when did the idea come about going to the Paralympics?
So that was like years after my accident. So I've never been interested really in kind of competitive sport. Well, I suppose I've always done a little bit, but when you're in a wheelchair and you like to be fit and active, then it seemed like people were just asking me all the time, have you ever thought about going to the Paralympics? So I started to think about it. But when I looked at what I could do there, I just wasn't attracted to any of it. So running around a track or swimming up and down a swimming pool didn't appeal. And then in 2008, I'd been on a sea kayaking holiday for a few weeks in Sweden, and I actually got a bit of a pressure injury on my bum. So I ended up lying on my tummy for about 3 weeks, just waiting for this kind of mark, these marks on my backside to disappear. And it coincided with the Beijing Paralympics, and I saw that hand cycling was in it for the first time. And when I saw it, I just had this idea. I was like, well, that'd be cool. I love hand cycling. I go every day anyway. Maybe I should just train and figure out and see if I can get to the next Olympics, which will be in London, which was kind of my inspiration, the fact that it was in my own country, and then also that hand cycling was in it, and that was something that I was really, loved to do. So I think if you're going to be good at something, I think it has to be something, ideally something that you enjoy doing. Otherwise, you'd just be have a fairly hard time of it.
I do wonder, I'm kind of something like hand cycling. I'm no hand cyclist, but I know, like, obviously it's an endurance sport, and I'm curious as to how you keep yourself motivated with something like that. How you don't fall out of love with a sport when it's something individual that you have to get yourself up over and over again to keep training.
It's a good question, and you obviously know the challenges of training for a sport. You're a para skier, so you've done it too. But that question of motivation, I think, is really interesting. So, I find like so each I never ever planned to do it for this long. I don't know how it happened. Like I always knew it would be part of my life, but something that I'd do just for recreation, for fun, with friends, for fitness. I never expected to be kind of in a Paralympic zone for over a decade. So that is a really interesting question. So the London Games, the motivation was very much about it's all new. Is it even possible? I called it my Olympic experiment. So that made it feel less intense because it was like, well, an experiment, you don't know what the outcome is. You're just trying something out to see what happens. So it kind of felt like not non-committal, but just felt like you could just go and see what happened. You were just kind of playing with it. So that was the first round. It was like, is it possible? And it was kind of a playful thing. And then probably about 6 months out from London, before I'd been selected, I still wasn't on the team. Of course, you have all these self-doubts, but then I suddenly realized this isn't an experiment anymore because I've actually put a lot of effort in and I've really committed to this for 3.5 years. So now it feels important to try and make it there. And unfortunately, I did. And I guess I'd always assumed that would be the end. But because I won a medal, then suddenly there was funding and it was like, are you going to Rio? Are you going to try for it? So then I kind of I guess I went into the tunnel, if you know what I mean. It was like blinkers on, just total commitment. And of course, the motivation for those 4 years was like, how could you possibly win a gold medal? Because I like never win races. I think I've won like one race in Italy, which was the prize was a giant sausage, and there was like nobody fast there. And the only other race I've ever won was the Paralympics in Rio. But it just became
Wow,
this massive,
really?
like, yeah. So it just became this massive. I think I won one in 2014, a World Cup, which was actually after having been hit by a car 9 months before and losing all movement in my arm. I suppose I always just check in with my motivation. Rio, it was like, is it possible to win a gold medal? And then now with Tokyo, I totally lost motivation for a year or two, not in terms of not riding, but I was like scared of getting injured or ill again because I was kind of fairly burnt out after Rio. And but now I do have motivation again, and it's like I kind of have this belief that it must be possible to be on really good physical form when you're really listening to your body and honoring that, and not just always squeezing yourself and pushing yourself, but being like, you know what, I am tired. I'm going to rest and I'm going to enjoy this process. So this time it's really about absolutely just going for enjoying it and using all the wisdom that you've got after years of doing something to stay healthy, enjoy the process, and just see what happens. You know, not attached to anything, just follow that process. And I'm pleased to report that this morning I got an all-time personal best for half an hour. So that was,
Nice.
but then that's like the macro motivation, if you know what I mean. And then there's like micro motivation of every day. And I think that varies, and it's definitely helped by spending my winters in Mallorca when you're not waking up to a grey wet sky and the thought of doing 4 hours on a turbo trainer. So I think daily motivation is another topic which we could spend the whole hour talking about. But if anyone's interested, they can come to all of my webinars on motivation.
I'll come to your podcast when you do it yourself. I wonder, like, from when you first started in your first race in hand cycling, how long was that period until you got to 2012?
Oh, so I think my first race was, well, I'd done a couple of races before I ever started training, and I literally came so last, and there wasn't even a finish level, like really, really bad. I think it was 180 kilometers, like
Wow.
it was totally crazy around Lac Leman. But I think we were about 140 kilometers in, and they were like, "That's it, you're timed out." And I was like, "I'm not doing this," and then quitting. I'm like, "I'm carrying on, even if there's no finish line." But I think my first kind of focused race towards London was in 2009, and I think I was last in that as well, or next to last. And at the time, this, you know, Rachel Morris had competed for Britain in the Beijing Paralympics and won a gold medal. So I think the British champs in 2010, I think she lapped me like two or three times. So, you know, you kind of just think, well, I may as well just give up here. What's the point? So I suppose my message to anyone aspiring to achieve anything in sport is just to say, or in life, is just to say, never give up. Just keep believing and keep trying if you want to do it, because surprising things happen.
Definitely. It seems like from reading your book that you have completely figured out how to train your brain. And that's a question in the sports psychology that you have kind of you've learned for yourself. For me, and actually we're the same level of injury, so that's kind of I'm T3 as well. And you skied too, right? You skied kind of on the backup trip.
When I first learned to ski, I was like, that's it. I love the mountains.
So, like for me, I love skiing as well, and it was the thing that gave me it made me truly happy. I went to quite soon after my injury, and I was like, this is the thing, just that freedom and that independence and stuff.
But with my kind of journey, I didn't want to race initially. That wasn't my intention. I wanted to be not falling over the whole time, and just to carry on doing it. And I just kind of fell into racing. It sometimes happens like that. And for me, it just happened a bit too fast. I love skiing, but racing just kind of took that enjoyment away from me a little bit.
I had so much kind of negative talk, and I was just so competitive, kind of, and comparing myself to other people constantly. And I think, as a T3, you'll know as well. On the ski race circuit, we're few and far between, and that was a really difficult thing to just stop comparing myself to other people. What do you think from a sort of sports psychology perspective, are the couple of things that you've learned that have helped you most with dealing with that kind of negative self-talk and that comparison and stuff like that?
Yeah, so well, there's a load of things, but I am running some courses at the moment on Train Your Brain, which are for, in to some degree, they're for sports people. Actually, the content is perfect for life, not just for sport. But yeah, some I kind of talk about the connection between the three P's, so psychology, phraseology. So what I mean by that is what we're saying, and our physiology. So it's really I think those are like three access points to really changing how we're thinking, and that changes how we feel, and how we feel changes how we behave, and that changes the outcomes and the results. So I think we have to become really conscious of what we're thinking and realize that we're not controlled by our brain. We can control it. We can decide to stop thinking something and just think something else. And it's not easy to start with, because it's like changing a habit of a lifetime to tell her. But most people that I work with and coach are so good at telling themselves negative things, and so good at being really unkind to themselves. Like, we're so nice to other people often, yet we tell ourselves messages that are horrendous. We finish something and go, "I'm rubbish, I'm useless," and you'd never say that. Being conscious of what you're thinking and choosing to change that, and knowing that it's hard work, you've got to keep working at it. It's not something that just happens overnight. And then noticing what you're saying. So it's really kind of, it's sometimes harder to notice it yourself, but you'll see it in other people. People have their common phrases, like, and there's certain things that I just cannot stand. Like, people go, oh, you're getting old, or oh, I've got this injury, or it's my age. And I'm like, no, stop with these stories. So I think you just really need to kind of catch what your story is and change your story if you want to change. Like, the more you just keep telling yourself the same old story, that you're rubbish, that you're weaker, that you're this, that you're that, the more you just keep creating that. So check what you're thinking, check what you're saying. And then I do a lot of work with my body, like controlling how I'm feeling. So, when you get anxious and people get butterflies or fluttery chest, etc., I'm trained as a hypnotherapist. So, you can control that with your mind as well. So, meditation, deep breathing. There's tons of amazing stuff out there, like the amazing Wim Hof, the guy that does all the ice showers and baths and deep breathing, feel, and therefore how you behave.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's so interesting. I've started meditating quite a lot recently, and it's helped me so much. And now, I've sacked off the skiing a few years ago, and now I'm kind of water skiing, and I'm noticing as I'm kind of understanding this stuff a bit more and trying to change that sort of conversation in my brain, things are kind of coming to me a little easier, which is nice.
I think the thing is that those kind of the negative self-talk, the negative language, the putting yourself down, the getting anxious about stuff, it's just like, it's not fun. It's really, I mean, life is short, and we need to not make ourselves suffer so much by putting ourselves through all this kind of mental torture that we do. So I think it's an amazing thing when you discover it, because you can actually give up on trying, or doing things that are challenging, but you can have so much more kind of fun with it, or just less stress with it. Yeah.
Yeah, I get you. So with London, you did amazingly well and you came back with a silver medal. Well, you didn't come back. You stayed in your home country with a silver medal. Tell me about kind of going into Rio 4 years on to that. How were you going into that games?
Yeah, so London was a surprise. I think the crowds and that home atmosphere helped a lot. And then Rio, yeah, like for a few years I didn't really know. And then I had kind of most incredible experience with Rio, really. I think I saw the course and I just thought, that course is, if there's ever a course that I'm going to go well on, that's the course. It was flat. I'm quite heavy for a rider, so I'm just short of 6 foot. So compared to quite a lot of my competitors, some of them are like 20 kilos lighter than I am when they're little short asses. So I kind of keep up some momentum and then go quite well over a long flat course. So I was like, that could be something that I could do really well on. And I think I just set my sights on it, and basically just decided I'm going to give it everything to try and And I just started to believe it was possible. And I started to do all these things like just imprint gold into my brain, into my life, and put gold shoes and a gold phone cover and a gold laptop cover, and started talking about gold, and not in a cocky way, not in a way that I absolutely thought I could at all. Because, you know, I think the expression respect all and fear none is a really great expression, but I just kind of started to believe it might be possible and work towards that. And yeah, I still think something magical happened on the day. I'm not a religious person, but I kind of do believe that there's more to the eye than what we see, and that we're all connected, and that our thoughts are real forces and they're kind of powerful. And, you know, it kind of intrigues me that people talk about this kind of woo-woo spiritual world as if it's something totally odd, but actually, you know, we can send an email and it can be on the other side of the world in seconds. And why can't we believe that actually our thoughts can impact things as well? So I think I've used a lot of kind of woo-woo thought things in Rio that helped me.
Definitely. Something you wrote about in your book, the example you use was when you're kayaking down a river. Now, there's a section in the river which is really rocky, and obviously you want to avoid the rocks. But when you're kind of going down it, if you're thinking about and looking at the rocks, then you're going to head straight for the rocks. And you can use this analogy in life, you know, as in if you're thinking about something and focusing on something, you will attract that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm mastering it all slowly, but, you know, there's periods of time, for example, when you're paralyzed, you might lay around feeling really sorry for yourself, focusing on what you haven't got anymore and all the lack in your life. And actually, that's not really going to get you where you want to be. So I think I learned fairly early on that what we focus on is what we get. And actually, if we can start to focus on what we still have and what we still can do, instead of focusing on what we haven't got and what we can probably attract more possibility and more opportunity and more good times to yourself than you will if you're focusing on the other stuff.
Totally. I'm with you. I found it interesting hearing about your race in Rio, with what happened there. It's extraordinary about your chain coming off.
Yeah, the whole race is still a mystery to me. So basically I injured my shoulder just before flying to Rio. I kind of think I must have ripped a muscle in the shoulder during a holding camp. Which is probably, you're kind of walking that line of overtraining and just getting to the point where you need to be really fit but not overdo it. And I think I basically overdid it. So pulled a muscle, could barely push my wheelchair off the bus when we got to the Paralympic village in Rio. Spent the whole week in physio, getting ice, couldn't ride, couldn't recce the course, just had to recce it in a car. Then, so I turned up on race day with tape everywhere and needing to take ibuprofen for kind of pain. And then my chain fell off in the middle of the race and I had to actually physically stop and pick it up and put it back on. And my power was really poor compared to what I can do. So I just thought I'd blown it. Like, I've crossed the finish line, threw a towel over my head and just was like, oh. And then the team manager came and ripped the towel off my head and was like, gold. So I still don't know how on earth that happened. It's kind of this very mysterious
mindset,
thing to me.
Perhaps.
Power of mind. I do believe it was power of mind, but yeah, clearly with a lot of good hard training beforehand. Yeah. And so I think what happened that week before, rather than letting all the injuries and the kind of apparent unperfectness of it get me down, I just was like, maybe this is perfect, maybe I need this rest, maybe I just kept reframing everything in the most positive way possible, which I think I've become a bit of a master of. And maybe we all become quite good at that when we're you know, paralyzed, because life is, you know, every day presents new challenges to all of us. It's kind of like we don't get chance to get into a comfort zone. We don't get chance to get that lazy, because if you actually step out into the world, then inevitably almost every day is going to present you with a challenge, which my brain really, you know, that plasticity in your brain and all your neurons are having to figure out new ways of working all the time, creative solutions. So yeah, I think it helps.
I love that. And a gold medal. I mean, massive. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's it. Incredible. And you say, you know, you talk about kind of not really having an opportunity to be lazy, you know, in this sort of paraplegic life. And I've been loving reading up about the adventures that you've been on. I enjoy adventures, but I definitely kind of want to kind of push a bit more and do some more things out of my comfort zone. So reading up about what you've been up to has been amazing.
I was completely blown away by your experiences as a paraplegic of climbing El Capitan.
El Capitan is a 1,000 meter overhanging rock face, for anyone who doesn't know, in Yosemite National Park, right? In California. Tell me about that as a climber who had their injury doing the same thing. Yeah, tell me about that.
I was out of my comfort zone. an ex-partner was a big climber. He suggested we go and climb it together, and he climbed it 12 times at the time. So I think this was going to be the 13th time. And my initial reaction was just like, no way, don't be crazy. Like, it just seemed mad. And then, of course, it seems to be my nature that then I'm like, hang on a minute. Okay, well, let's look at this. Maybe there is a way. And of course, somebody had climbed it already, an American guy who, I've forgotten his name now, blimey. Anyway, it had been climbed by an American guy who's paraplegic, so by a couple of Americans actually. So it's been done. And so I was like, well, it's not impossible. And so, yeah, let's just go for it and try it. I was petrified of heights. I suppose all that memory somewhere in my body of the trauma of falling off a cliff. I was unconscious, so I don't actually really remember any of it in my conscious mind, but it's locked in my body somewhere or has been. So to go back to a cliff and be hanging up there was super, super scary. And it takes about, most people take about a week to climb El Capitan. It has been speed climbed in like a day and things, but without ropes and all that kind of crazy stuff. But most
Wow.
people take between about four and 7 days, depending what route they're doing. So you sleep up there, you sleep on a fabric ledge that you attach to the rock face and fold out. And actually, sleeping was my favorite time because you're tied to the rock face. Finally, you're kind of calm and still, and you're looking up at the stars. And it was really unbelievable to be in that kind of place, just in that environment. You know, it was one of those moments where you could just go, oh my God, this is mind-blowingly amazing to be in this place, hanging up, looking at these stars. And then during the day when we were moving and working our way up the rock face, that's when I was scared. Like, you know, you have to leave the ledge, obviously. And I basically behaved like a big bag. So you've got all your bags with you, with all your food and your sleeping bags and all your stuff for all the time that you're up there. And when you let go of a bag, it swings out. Most of the rock face is overhanging, so the bag swings out into space and just pendulums around. And so I basically behaved like a big bag. So you're just swinging around in kind of outer space with the wind blowing you, and sometimes the ropes got tangled. So it was my biggest lesson ever, in overcoming fear, in facing fear, like right in the face of it, and having to just find a way around it there and then, because there was no way out. You're up there. If I froze or freaked out, other than a helicopter coming in and having some crazy, crazy rescue, there's no way out. It was just like you have to just deal with your brain here and sort it out. And I suppose that was one of the times when I realized that we are in control of our thoughts and we can change our physiology. So there were times when I was crying, I was sweating, my palms were just dripping, my heart was going crazy because I was so scared. And then I'm like, okay, just pull that DVD out. So if you were watching like a horror film, you could just change it to a comedy. I think the brain is the same. Stop feeding yourself all those panic messages. Take loads of deep breaths. Start feeding your brain the right stuff, and you can kind of calm yourself down and work through it.
Amazing to like come to that realization when you're like hanging off a cliff.
I mean,
Incredible.
it's not quite as straightforward as it sounds. We actually
Yeah.
failed the first time. We dropped some food and we had to come back down. And then it was like, do we just go on a beach holiday and walk away? And I was like, oh no, it's just how I'm made, but we're gonna have to go back and try again. So yeah.
I wonder, like, how practically does it work? Like, as a paraplegic, when you can't use your legs, how do you do that?
Yeah, so LCAPs mainly, we picked a route that was mainly overhanging, so I was basically hauling myself up the rope. I had like knee pads on and ankle guards and stuff to protect myself from being scraped on the rock. I did a lot of work looking at how to set up my sitting position to avoid pressure sores. So obviously you can't just wear a climbing harness where all that pressure would be you're hanging on your bones all day in just a few places. So we ended up using a parapontine harness with lots of padding and gel and stuff in it to just avoid kind of pressure sore problems. And then you're only like really hanging in it full pressure when you're pulling up the rope. And then when you got to the ledge, you could lie down and kind of, you know, change positions and sort of save all that pressure problems. But yeah, toileting up there was probably, as ever with paraplegia or quadriplegia, the biggest challenge.
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of brings me on as well to your trip when you crossed the Greenland ice cap. Like, mind-blowing. Spent a month crossing it with a cross-country sit ski. I've done like a day of cross-country sit skiing and it was amazing. And often the setting is incredible. And you know, I'm sure in Yosemite as well, that must have been just such a blessing to be in those surroundings. But yeah, I just wonder how the hell you managed to spend 30 days 30 days kind of in that environment. And I mean, to be really honest, I've been sort of I've had my spinal cord injury nearly 10 years and I've camped once and that was kind of because I had to with backup. And there's definitely a fear I need to get over, but doing it for 30 days like in ice, how the hell do you manage that as a person with a disability?
You know what, I mean, I look back at the trip as well and I'm like, how the hell did you do that? And I think it's just a reminder as well that when you just decide you're doing something, somehow you do it. So I did plan really well, and really I was so scared about that trip, and I ended up just listing everything that I was worried about going wrong. And a lot of that was to do with staying warm, temperature regulation, catheter problems, bowel problems, thinking through all of that sort of detail that's connected to disability. So I suppose the stuff that people are normally thinking about, like, you know, can they ski the distance, was less of an issue than all the other stuff, which is normal for us, I think. But I just basically went through that list and figured out little things that I could do for everything that would make me feel a bit better about it. So, you know, like all the joins between my catheter and bags and different things, I taped up with cloth tape just to make sure nothing could come undone, and washed my bladder out twice a day to make sure that nothing was going to get blocked, and slept with bladder washers in my sleeping bag so they wouldn't freeze. Figured out like a toilet I could use inside the tent so I wouldn't get a frostbitten bottom. And yeah, I suppose the devil's in the detail, isn't it? So if you pay attention to all that little stuff, then it gives you enough confidence eventually to go. But of course, I'm human, so I was petrified. And 2 weeks before we left, I was like, oh my, what am I doing? Like, I'm crazy. And I think at that point, 3 able-bodied teams had begun the crossing that year and they'd all been rescued for different reasons. So I was like, what are we doing? But yeah, we made it and we had no problems. But yeah, I think just you have to just train well, unpick the detail. And it's a topic that's up for me again, because I've been crossing the 7 continents in different ways these last 4 years, and there's one continent remaining and it's Antarctica. So in about 15 months time, that's destination Antarctica, and I'm back in that zone of being petrified, trying to figure out what I'll do. And nothing stays the same, so my personal circumstances medically have changed. I have to use water irrigation to go to the toilet, so it's like trying to figure out how that will work in a cold place and how batteries won't run out, and just, you know, all a whole next level of challenge, which you know, I suppose maybe I kind of thrive on challenge and figuring things out. But yeah,
I love that. You know, we're talking about this incredible trip that the vast majority of people on this planet wouldn't dream of doing, and we immediately talk about those practical elements, not the fact that you pushed across, not using your legs but using your arms. Like, how was that as a physical challenge every day to be getting up and just, yeah, doing that the whole time? You must have been broken physically.
Yeah, so that was all pre-Olympic journey. So I was just a slightly chubby person working on a laptop or in an office all day before that with a kind of proper job. So I trained for it, obviously, and I went and visited the Norwegian Paralympic ski team and discovered how they train in summer with ski poles that dig into tarmac. So I just poled around for like the year before in my wheelchair around all the lanes of Scotland where I lived and got those kind of muscles really strong. But yeah, physically, I think it's still like just about the hardest thing I've ever done endurance wise. And I used to wake up in the morning, and because you're gripping your ski poles like all day, and we had to ski 55 minutes and a 5 minute break, 55 minutes, 5 minute break for between 8 and 10 hours a day. That was the only way we were going to get across. And we had my friend Passy, who's Finnish, who was, he's a like ex-Finnish military, he was like stationed on the Finnish-Russian border or something for years, so he's absolutely hard as nails, and he basically was like, this is how we're going to do it, we just have to be super super disciplined, and that's, this is what we'll do. So luckily we're under the guidance of his experience, but yeah, I used to wake up in the mornings and I just could not open my hands because it was so exhausted from gripping ski poles all day, and my friend had to like unpeel my hands so the tendons could sort of stretch, and you think, can't do this again. And then of course you get up and you start and you just do it again, and before you know it we'd cross the ice. But yeah,
that's incredible. It sounds like the people in your life have played a huge part in your journey and having them around from the beginning.
Yeah, completely. I mean, none of the things I've done could have done alone, and neither would I want to. It's not that much fun doing it on your own. So I think one of the things that I love about these kind of trips and expeditions and challenges is that I get to be part of a team with either good friends or with total strangers, and there's something really special about being part of a team with a common objective. And it's not always easy. Like, there's been plenty of fallouts in teams and people that don't speak to each other again, and you know, that kind of hard side of it, but also very special. And yeah,
awesome. So I'm wondering about your work as a transformational coach, what you'll do with that and what your plans are kind of now.
Yeah, so I suppose I know my life has taken me on quite a roller coaster journey, and along that external journey of adventures and Paralympic sport, I've always traveled, I've always explored quite deeply internally as well, if that makes any sense. So I suppose you might describe it as doing a lot of work on yourself, like processing emotions and digging deep and figuring stuff out. And I really have always probably been attracted to that side of things, but also increasingly studied the whole way of different techniques to help other people. So I feel like that's where, you know, that's where I am, and that's where I want to go further, is to support other people in their journeys. And I think I've struggled with it for a long time because I kind of think, who am I to tell anyone ways that they can figure things out? Like, what do I know? But now I've kind of decided just I need to step up. Like I have learned a lot of stuff, and I haven't got everyone's answers, but I really believe everyone has their own answers. And but there's times when we need help to figure, you know, to help us find those ways forward, and just a bit of inspiration. Or so I'm not an advice giver. I try and help people on their journey and walk at their side with them and help them realize stuff that's, you know, that matters to them, what their passions and values and what the blocks are. Just kind of take them, yeah, be with them on their journey for a while and help them through. So
I love that. It sounds incredible. I think you're well qualified to support people. And I love that, you know, it is people's own journeys, you know, people's lives take a different course, and it's figuring out, you know, that in, when I was speaking to David Smith, who I believe, you know, the cyclist, he spoke a lot about purpose and what individuals' purposes are. And that, I think that's a really key thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of believe that we all have that thing that really brings us alive, which is like our purpose. I feel lucky to have found mine, and it feels like it is about helping people with their journeys, and it feels really important to me. But yeah, not everyone's lucky to have found it, and some people find it really early in life and they're just on a mission, they know what they're doing, and it took me a while to get there. But I think once we find that purpose and that passion and can find a path with it, then it's, you know, a really, really fulfilling way to live. And I think there's never you feel like you've never worked a day in your life when you're on that path as well. So
definitely. So on each episode of my podcast, I ask my guests what piece of advice they would give for people going through a challenge of their own. It's you know, not just for people with a disability, but, you know, anyone with something that they're facing. It's kind of a hard question, but what advice do you think you would give for other people?
Don't be scared, be curious. Be excited. Like, change, challenge, it can be really intimidating, it can be really scary, but it can also be really exciting. Like, we don't know what's coming next. So I think I kind of believe that when we step into the unknown, it's an opportunity to discover all sorts of exciting new things about ourselves and about the world and about people around us. So yeah, just even though it might seem like the worst thing in the world, whatever it is you're facing, I really believe that it's, if we can face it with curiosity and look for the learning, just to constantly be kind of looking, well, hey, what can I learn from this? Then it just brings amazing gifts in it instead of the struggle.
I love that. That's amazing. Brilliant. So to kind of finish off, Karen, where can we find out more about you and what you're up to?
I'm really not that great at doing all this kind of stuff, so I really need someone to help me with social media things. But yeah, I've got a website, which is my name, Karen Dark with an E on the end, .com. So there's lots of things on there. There's a link on there to the project I've been doing the last 4 years, Quest 79, to the Pole of Possibility, which is the Antarctica project. I'm trying to get people involved with the Antarctica project. So in brief, I won the 79th medal for Britain in Rio. 79 is the atomic number of gold. I used to be a gold geologist, so all this kind of came together. And I decided to start a project called Quest 79. So my quest was to cycle across seven continents, or journey across seven continents, but encouraging other people to take on their own Quest 79, to step out of their comfort zone, try something new, whatever it might be. It could just be, well, I've done some work with some amazing kids who've done amazing things. Like, one 10-year-old boy decided he wanted to climb 79 peaks in 79 weeks. And then his classmates had all sorts of other challenges. Like, some of them just said, I'm going to get 79 minutes of fresh air a week, because at the moment I never go outside. My mum gave up alcohol for 79 days. My dad rode 79 miles for 79 years. My nephews rode 79 miles on the bike ride with when they were like 8 years old or something. So it could be small. You might think it's a small thing, but if it's a big thing for you, or if it's just a step out of your comfort zone, then it's an amazing thing. So I'm trying to encourage people to do that and to let me know what that is. And if they want to raise money for a charity in the process, brilliant, let me know, and then we'll get your name on the flag at the Pole of Possibility. So there's a link to the POP challenge on the Pole of Possibility website, which goes through for mine. And I'd love to hear from anyone who just wants to challenge themselves and let me know how that goes for you and what you discover along the way.
Wicked, wicked. We love a challenge. That's awesome.
And if anyone wants to train your brain, I've got some workshops on that. So just that's I think that's on my website somewhere as well.
Sounds awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for doing this, Karen. It's been really, really nice to talk to you.
No, thank you. Amazing. Thanks for inviting me.
You've been listening to A Life Less Ordinary with me, Sophie Elwes. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, maybe hit subscribe button and share it with anyone you think would be interested. Thanks so much, and see you next time.